This will be part three of the overview of the entire Bible. And in part one, we covered Genesis. And then in part two, we got from Exodus to 2 Samuel. And this time, we're going to start off in 1 Kings. 1 Kings is it's a record of the kings of Israel. And that probably the title would pretty well give that away, you would think. It covers both the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom of Israel. Who knows what the northern kingdom was called? Anybody remember? It was just called Israel. Yeah. And the southern kingdom was called?
Judah.
Yes, that's right. 1 Kings would have been written in around 943 B.C. Let's see, chapters 2 through 11 give a history of the kingdom of Solomon, David's son. So he has quite a bit that's dedicated to him. And a little bit of review from last time. Who remembers who Solomon's mother was? Remember? Anybody?
Bathsheba.
Very good. So interestingly enough, Solomon is one of the greatest, probably one of the most marvelous kings of Israel. Israel was probably at its zenith under Solomon. And it had a lot to do with the where Israel was geographically in the world. It was a crossroads between the south and the Roman Empire and the Persian Empire. And there was a lot of traffic that would go through that area of the world. And whenever they would go through, they would have need to exchange money and buy and trade and things like that. So there's a lot of wealth that went through Israel at that time. And Solomon ended up probably ruling over Israel when it was at its peak. And this is still what the Jews today look for. They look to get back to the days of Solomon. That's they think the Messiah is going to come back and set up a kingdom like Solomon had. And that's what they were looking for in the first century as well.
Did you say that was 954 B.C., somewhere around there?
943 B.C., yep. So yeah, just about 1,000 years before Jesus was born. So Solomon was the first heir of David's throne. David reigned for 40 years. And then Solomon, his son, took over, not after a couple of his sons tried to take over before that. What's his name? Long-haired.
Oh, Absalom.
Absalom.
Yes. It's Caleb's nickname.
Yes. Absalom tried to take the kingdom. And then right before Solomon, or right about at the time when Solomon was taking over the kingdom, a son named Adonijah, I think it was his name, he tried to take the kingdom too. So poor David, before he died, he had two insurrections by two of his sons, and he ended up paying for that sin of his, the sin of adultery. He didn't only lose the son that was born of it, but then he ended up paying for that in the end, too.
He was also lax on discipline, wasn't he?
He was. Yes, he was. It says that he, yeah, with Absalom and with Adonijah, too. I think it was said of Adonijah that he didn't displease him at any time. So your job as a parent is to displease your children.
Right.
If they are always happy with you, you're not doing a good job. So when Solomon became the king of Israel, God told him that he could have anything that he desired. Now who remembers what Solomon asked for?
Wisdom.
Wisdom, yep. He could have had anything. And because he asked for wisdom, God gave him everything that he could have asked for. God gave him wisdom, he gave him riches, and he gave him power. He gave it all to him. So, and why do you think Solomon writes the book of Proverbs, which we'll get into later on, probably yet today? And he exalts wisdom above all else. He was the wisest man that ever lived, except for one person. Who's that? Who is wiser than Solomon? Jesus, that's right. Very good. Did they steal it from you? You had it? Oh. Yeah, if we're going to talk about who the best person is in any regard, Jesus would always probably be a good answer. Right? It said he was greater than Moses, greater than Jonas is here, Jesus said, greater than Solomon is here. Jesus was the greatest man that ever lived. Now, Solomon built God's original temple. Prior to the building of the temple, Israel worshiped God in what kind of a building? Who remembers? What do you remember? What did they worship God in?
Tabernacle.
The tabernacle. Yep. The tabernacle was like a tent. And they'd put the tabernacle up, and then they would worship God, and then they would take it down, and they would move it from place to place. And David had a desire to make God a house, to make God a temple. And because David was a bloody man, God said he had a lot of war and killed a lot of people. God would not let him build a temple, but David got to amass all the stuff, all the material together to build it. And then Solomon ended up building it. Kind of, I guess that could be a picture of New Testament evangelism. One plants, one waters, the Lord gives the increase type of thing. David did his part, and then Solomon got to put it all together. With a guy named Hiram. Hiram was another guy that helped out, which the Masons have co-opted. They call him Hiram Abiff, mm-hmm. You know. But that there actually was a guy named Hiram in the Bible. They think that Solomon was the first Mason too, mm-hmm. I do believe. They even had pictures of him in the temples and mm-hmm. the Masonic temples. So Solomon had a bunch of women. Who remembers how many women Solomon had?
Two.
He had more than two. He had 500 times as many as two. How many is 500 times two?
How many is 500 times two? What is it, Sam?
1,000,
yes. Solomon had 1,000 women. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines.
That is ridiculous.
Yeah. That is definitely ridiculous.
Bible study.
Yeah. Not to mention, you guys have a hard enough time taking care of one, let alone 1,000. Yeah, 700 wives and 300 concubines, or 300 porcupines, as one little girl said one time, wee little girl. But anyway, I don't know. How could you possibly have that many wives? I mean, even if you just loved one a day, it would still take you 3 years just to get through them all, you know? Yeah.
Would he have, multiple marriages, do you think, in a single day? How'd they even work?
Yeah, it would almost have to be like a group thing or something. Do you take these wives to be here? Yeah. Well, the problem was... Well, yeah, where would you even put them all? You'd have to have, Radisson down the road something.
He had money.
Yeah, he did. He even built a special house for the one. I think it was the Egyptian wife that he had that he took from Pharaoh. He built her a special house next to his own. So then the wives, though, ended up being his downfall. If you remember, the wives were from, a lot of them were from foreign lands, and they caused him to sin. And it says in the book of Nehemiah that outlandish women did cause him to sin, and he ended up learning their ways. And that's exactly what God said would happen. He told them in Deuteronomy not to marry outside of the faith. Don't marry the women of the other lands, because they will turn your heart away, and you will be corrupted by them. And he didn't listen. Actually, Solomon didn't listen to a lot of things that was said in the law. The very law that he as the king would have had to copy down, because each king had to make their own copy of the law. And in that law, it said that the king was not to multiply horses to himself. He was not to multiply women to himself. And he was not to multiply chariots, I think. Might have been gold and silver, I think. I think that was also said. A whole bunch of things. And you read throughout Solomon's life, he multiplied horses. He multiplied women. Just get a whole bunch of them.
Okay.
So. Yep. So he built and horses in those days would be a military thing, you know. So horses and chariots were the strength of the military. It'd be like tanks mm-hmm. these days or something. So
he wasn't supposed to have multiple wives.
No, none of them were. I mean, God's original plan was never. God's plan was one man, one woman from the beginning, and he suffered polygamy, just like he suffers divorce. And you can kind of, you don't exactly have a Bible verse that says that, but I think it's a fair extrapolation. When Jesus said, when the Pharisees asked if a man could put away his wife for any cause, and Jesus said that for the hardness of your hearts, Moses allowed you to put away your wives, but it was not so from the beginning. And the same thing could be said of polygamy, that it was God's plan, as Jesus said from the beginning, was one man and one woman. So yeah, the king was not to multiply wives, horses, chariots, gold and silver, all that stuff he was not to do, and he did. And then because of Solomon's unfaithfulness, God ended up rending the kingdom from him after his death. And 10 of the tribes went to his son, and then, or I'm sorry, 2 of the tribes went to his son, and then 10 of the tribes went to a guy, his servant, named, anybody remember who got the 10 tribes of Israel?
Yeah, I say Rehoboam.
Rehoboam got the two. Rehoboam was Solomon's son. He got two of the tribes, which were which two? Do you remember? Anybody
Judah
remember?
And Benjamin.
That's right. And then the other ten went to Jeroboam, which was Solomon's servant, who Solomon tried to kill. So since I don't have a lot of Bible verses in this study, let's go ahead and turn to 1 Kings 11, 11 through 13. And we can read about Jeroboam getting part of the kingdom here, or the greater part of the kingdom. 1 Kings 11, 11 through 13. It says, "Wherefore the Lord said unto Solomon, Forasmuch as this is done of thee, and thou hast not kept my covenant and my statutes which I have commanded thee, I will surely rend the kingdom from thee, and will give it to thy servant. Notwithstanding, in thy days I will not do it for David thy father's sake, but I will rend it out of the hand of thy son." God has done this in the past, too. If you remember with Ahab, remember the wicked king Ahab, which we'll get to here in a little bit. But he was a king of Israel, of the northern kingdom, and he was he sold himself to work wickedness. He was a terrible king. And whenever God finally said, all right, you know, the axe is coming down on your head, and Ahab, he didn't really say that, but anyway, Ahab then humbled himself and went softly, and God says, okay, I won't do it in your day, but it'll happen in your son's day. And so this is a pattern that has happened numerous times whenever people do wickedness, and then they humble themselves, and God says, okay, I'll pass it off to the next generation. Kind of like what's going to happen in this country. The older generation did a bunch of things they shouldn't have done, and God says, okay, well, I'll let you guys off the hook. I'm not sure why, and the next generation's going to get it. So, thanks a lot. Yeah. 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 And then verses 31 through 32. It says, "And he said to Jeroboam, Take thee 10 pieces, for thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, Behold, I will rend the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon, and will give 10 tribes to thee," speaking there to Jeroboam. "But he shall have 1 tribe for my servant David's sake, and for Jerusalem's sake, the city which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel." So he got Judah and he got Benjamin. Then after the death of Solomon, Solomon's son goes to take over. And instead of following the advice of the older, wiser men, Rehoboam takes the advice of the younger men that he grew up with that had the silver spoon in their mouth. See, the older, wiser men, when he went to them, and he basically asked them, well, you know, how should I rule? And they said, you know, your father's been pretty tough. He was a heavy taxer. He really worked the people. They built the temple. They built the Solomon's houses and castles and all kinds of stuff, and they needed a break. And the older men say, hey, if you just lighten it up a little bit, they'll serve you forever. That would seem pretty reasonable, right? Because after all, he's got fabulous wealth from Solomon anyway. But then he goes to the young guys and he says, well, what do you think I should do? And they're like, you tell them that my little finger is going to be thicker than your father's loins. He chastened you with whips, I'll chasten you with scorpions. And so he follows their advice. Well, 10 tribes revolt, and he loses, you know, almost 90% of the kingdom. So that just goes to show you, you know, young people are not always wise, and then they don't go for wise counsel, and look what happens. So Israel ends up being split into 2 kingdoms, the northern and the southern kingdom. And we know the northern kingdom was called Israel. Who knows what the capital of Israel was, the northern kingdom? Anybody?
Samaria,
yes, it was. Very good. And the capital of the southern kingdom of Judah was?
Jerusalem,
that's right. So the northern kingdom then was ruled by Jeroboam, all 10 tribes, and the southern kingdom was called Judah. It was comprised of Judah and Benjamin, and it was ruled by Rehoboam.
Pastor, do you know for sure, I've heard that that's the first time it's in 1 Kings that the word Jew appears in the Bible when referring to that southern kingdom of Judah.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. That's probably right.
Prior to the split, it was always Israel, and then when you had the northern and the southern, mm-hmm. that's the first time you have the word Jew used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which would make sense because Jew comes from Judah.
Judah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'd have to look up exactly when the first time it was used. But yeah, it wasn't used way back. Abraham was called a Hebrew. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Which I think comes from Eber. Yes. I do believe. Yep. Which was his brother or somebody. Father? Not father. Tiro was his father. Anyway, Eber was one of his kinsmen anyway. Okay, so then that takes us up to 1 Kings 12. And then in 1 Kings 12, it begins to record the reigns of the kings of Judah and Israel, 12 through 22. And I'm just going to read off the kings here. And I have references to show you which ones were good and bad. And I'm not going to read all the references if you want to get the outline. If you need to find a list of the kings and find out which ones are good and bad, you can always get the outline. I just did this sort of for my own use. One time when I was reading through the book of Kings, I went through and I thought it would be nice to jot down the kings as I go through. So whenever I would find the next king that I would get to, I'd write a note in the margin, and then I would put a little arrow and I would say whether he was from Judah or Israel, and then whether he was good or bad. And so it's just kind of, it's easy then when you flip through the book of Kings in my Bible, then you can find the king, you can see the kings very easily, and it's just easier to find stuff. So first king of Judah was Rehoboam. He was a bad king. Then we have Abijam, which is another bad king. These are all kings of Judah. Asa was a good king. And then Jehoshaphat was a good king. And Joram was a bad king. So in Judah here in the first period of the kingdom there anyway, you have five kings and two out of five were good. So they're not doing very well. They're at 40% right now of good and bad. But I guess, you know, it's all relative compared to Israel. They're doing a lot better because Israel is batting a big old fat zero here. They had all bad kings. You had Jeroboam was the first one. I didn't get into this in the study, but Jeroboam ended up creating his own religion up there in the northern kingdom of Israel because it was too far for the people to go from Samaria down to Judah, or down to Jerusalem. And he knew if they did go down there and start mingling with the Jews down there, with the southern kingdom, that they might end up learning their good behavior and bring it back. So he created his own religion, and he made the basis of the people, the priests, and then he made two places where he put golden calves, kind of stole that from his great-granddaddy Aaron back there in the book of Exodus, and he put a calf in Dan, and he put a calf in Bethel, and then people could go there to worship, and he made holy days and everything, so he did it up, no new thing under the sun, right? Idolatry, holy days, as they say, you go back and history repeats itself. So we got kings of Israel. These are all bad, so I'm not going to individually say they're bad. You got Jeroboam, you got Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Omri, Tibni, Ahab, and Uzziah. Ahaziah. These were all bad. About nine of them there. It gets kind of confusing as you go through because you have two kings in Israel and Judah reigning at the same time, and once in a while you have kings with the same name in Israel and Judah reigning at the same time, and then sometimes you have kings with the same name not reigning at the same time. So then it can get very confusing as you go through there. And then to add more confusion, sometimes the kings go by different names like Uzziah or Uzziah and Azariah, I think. I'm forgetting, but anyway, there was several kings that went by different names. So it can, and when you look in the New Testament, it refers to these kings. Sometimes it gives a different name than they went by in the Old Testament. So anyway, it can get a little bit tricky.
How it is right now, they use the same names and just recycle them, like the same five names, and they recycle Charles. Them through each of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's very confusing to keep mm-hmm. track of which king is which.
Yeah, like Bush, you know, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush. Yeah. Okay, so now that takes care of the book of 1 Kings. So now we get to the book of 2 Kings. 2 Kings comes after 1 Kings, in case you didn't know that. Now, the book of 2 Kings is the continuation of the kingdoms of Israel and of Judah, although Israel was short-lived by this point. Israel ends up going out of existence, which we'll get into here in a little bit, earlier than the the kingdom of Judah does. So we got some more kings of Judah here. We got a mixture of bad and good. We got Ahaziah, which was bad. We got Joash, which was good. Amaziah was good. Azariah was good. Jotham. And there's another one that has multiple names, Jotham. I can't remember what the other ones were. But anyway, Ahaz was bad. Hezekiah was good. So in this section, you got only two bad ones out of seven. So that was Judah's doing a little bit better now. Israel is still doing terrible. These are all bad that I'm going to list here, at least up in, let me see on the next page. Yeah, they're all bad. Yep, every single one of them. I don't think Israel had a good king, did they? Let's see. They had no good ones in the first period. They did not have a good king. They had nothing but bad kings. You think it's bad now. You know, we get the election, we get the Bush, Bushes, and then we get Obama, and who knows who the next guy is going to be. And we're just thinking, oh, this is terrible. We just keep getting bad ones. Well, imagine going through your history for hundreds of years and having nothing but bad ones.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Actually, I can too. Yeah, it's pretty much been that way since Thomas Jefferson. But anyway, well, there was a few good ones. The good ones, the good U.S. presidents, are the ones you've never heard of. The ones you've never heard of are not the ones that started the wars. They're not the ones that, you know, passed all the big social programs or whatever. They were the ones that vetoed everything that history has tried to flush down the memory hole. So, anyway. So, kings of Israel, these are all bad. Jehoram, or Joram, so there's one guy that had two different names. Jehu, he was good and bad. I take that back. Okay, so he did some good things, some bad things. So they got a half-good king out of the whole lineage of kings of Israel. Then we got Jehoahaz, Joash, Jeroboam, Zechariah, Shalom, Menahem, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, Pekahiah, Pekah, and Elah and Hoshea. I don't have the pronunciation marks here in the outline. I do in my Bible, so it's a little bit easier to pronounce these. So those were all bad, with the exception of Jehu. Jehu is quite a guy, very zealous individual, if you remember anything about him. So then we get to 2 Kings 17, and this records how the northern kingdom of Israel was conquered by the kingdom of... Who remembers who conquered the northern kingdom of Israel? Anybody?
Assyria.
Yep. Yeah, Syria and Assyria were actually two different...
No, I said Assyria.
You did say Assyria. Oh, okay. Good. All right.
I got it wrong even though
yeah.
I got it right.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so the Samaritan people ended up being formed by the king of Assyria, bringing people in from foreign nations and replacing the Jews that were in northern Israel there. So if you ever wonder where the Samaritans come from, and you wonder why the Samaritans were so hated, especially in the New Testament, you know, when Jesus came to when he went through Samaria, the disciples were just shocked that he would even walk through this place, and then he was talking to some woman that had five husbands, and yet he was. And the woman was shocked that Jesus stopped to talk to her. If you remember what she said in John chapter 4, she said that the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. You know, thou being a Jew, askest drink of me, she says. This is just shocking to her. Well, this is the reason, because going way back, these Samaritans are like half-breed Jews to start with. I mean, you got the northern kingdom of Israel, who are totally screwed up. They haven't had a good king in hundreds of years. And then they get taken over by Assyria, and then they bring in people to replace the Jews. And whenever they do this, the people start to be killed off. The lions come in and they kill them, and they can't figure out what's going on. So they have some of the Levites come up there and teach these half-breed Jews that have been brought in from Assyria how to serve the Lord. And it says there that they feared the Lord and served their gods. Turn with me to 2 Kings 17:33. So this will give you an idea of why the Samaritans were so scorned and hated by the Jews, because they weren't even really Jews, half of them, and they were idolaters. But I'm not sure why the rest of Israel would have a whole lot of standing there to complain against them. If you read through some of the prophets, Israel was pretty much given to idolatry for most of its existence. 2 Kings 17 and verse 33, it says, "They feared the Lord and served their own gods, after the manner of the nations whom they carried away from thence. So isn't this kind of the history of a lot of religions, mixing in God's religion with heathen religion? And isn't that kind of what Christianity is today, especially Catholicism? Catholicism is the ancient Samaritan religion, basically. They feared the Lord and they served their other gods. And that's exactly what happened with Catholicism, if you look historically. Catholicism started out with the church in Rome, like the church that Paul wrote to, right? And then eventually it gets morphed into the monstrosity it is today. And in an effort to convert the pagans, they end up bringing the pagan customs into Christianity, and then that morphs itself into Catholicism. So they feared the Lord and served other gods. I think there's probably more other gods in there than fearing the Lord at this point.
That's an interesting verse to apply to Catholicism, because there are a lot of God-fearing Catholics. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're very moral, and they're very decent people.
Right.
A lot of them I've met in with and
stuff. Mm-hmm.
And yet they have a start day, the 40 days fasting, giving up something, and all the other stuff. So it really kind of fits.
Yep, it does. When the transubstantiation and all those pagan things that they brought in. Mm-hmm. Yep. Feared the Lord. The holy days, And they have, back in the day, they said that there used to be a holiday almost every day of the week in Europe. They couldn't get anything done because they were partying it up every day. So this is why, like I said in John 4:9, why the woman said that the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Kind of makes sense. But it's interesting that Samaria still had a priority in God's plan anyway, because whenever Jesus sent the apostles out, where did he send them to first of all? Jerusalem, then Judea, which was the surrounding area of Jerusalem, and then Samaria, and then to the uttermost parts of the earth. So God still has a place in his heart, I guess you could say, for Samaria. Now, 2 Kings 18 through 24 records the kings of Judah up until the time of the Babylonian captivity. So Judah was spared for a little while longer than Israel was. Israel was exceptionally wicked, and they were taken over, and then Judah gets their comeuppance a little bit later. So here's the remaining kings of Judah. And as you see, in the last group, there was a bunch of good kings. And they were pretty good, and then Israel gets taken over by Assyria. You'd think that they might take heed and fear, lest the same thing happens to them. But then we just see one bad king after another. We got Manasseh. He was one of the worst kings Israel ever had. But the interesting thing about him is that though he was one of the worst, and it even says that he did worse than the heathen, he repented and he turned because he saw what God's judgment was going to be on him, and he repented, and the Lord heard his prayer, and the Lord had mercy on him. Then you have Ammon, which was his son. He was bad. Then Josiah was a good king, one of the best kings of Israel. And it was during that time, during Josiah's time, that they found the book of the law again. It had been lost for a long time, and they found it under Josiah, and Josiah brought it out and had them read it. And then you have Jehoahaz, and Jehoiakim, and Jehoiakin, and Zedekiah, which were all bad kings. And old Zedekiah was the one that Jeremiah prophesied against, and he said that Zedekiah would not see the land of Babylon. He would not see Babylon. And yet he went to Babylon. The king Nebuchadnezzar took him over and carried him off to Babylon. But the prophecy was true. He did not see Babylon because they plucked his eyes out before he went. And he was the last king of Judah. Then 2 Kings 24 and 25 records how Judah was conquered by the king of Babylon. Who knows what the king of Babylon's name was? Anybody remember? King?
Nebuchadnezzar.
Very good. Nebuchadnezzar comes over and takes them over and hauls the Jews, a lot of them, carries them captive back to Babylon for how long? Who knows how long the Babylonian captivity was? Anybody?
40 years?
Nope.
60?
Nope. You're closer.
70?
70, very good.
Wow, Ava,
good.
Nice.
You guys need to start studying your Bible with Ava, apparently. You might learn something. Okay, so that takes us to the end of 2 Kings then. 2 Kings ends with Judah, Israel being carried off to Babylon. Now, when we get to the prophets, and I don't know if we get to them today or not, if we don't, we'll definitely start into them next time. But we'll see that a lot of the prophets prophesied during these times. So we're still going chronologically as we go through the Bible. Up until 2 Kings, we're still chronological, and the next few books of the Bible are still going to be chronological events. And then we're going to get to a point where it's not chronological anymore, and we start to go back and we'll intersperse during the periods that we've already covered. And so, for instance, Isaiah prophesied back in the days of these kings, back in the days of Hezekiah and some of the other kings. And Jeremiah prophesied towards the end of the nation of Judah, and he prophesied that they would be taken over by Babylon and they would be there for 70 years. And I'll get into that. And as we go through the prophets, I'll point you back the ones that we know for sure when they prophesied, and I'll show you where they prophesied at what time period and kind of sparse them in their place in time.
Pastor, when did the Babylonian captivity happen or start? We're at 1000 BC with Solomon, and we have all these kings in the northern and southern.
Yeah, let's see, the Babylon, I'm going to have to cheat. I'm going to flip it. Well, actually, I could tell you. Mm-hmm. Let's see, because the Babylonian captivity was 70 years from the time of the commandment to rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah was 483. So it was about, that would have been about 450 BC when the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem would have been, and then go back another 70 years. So we'd be talking 520, roughly. About 520 would have been whenever Israel was taken over by the Babylonians, roughly. 520, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, 895, 1020 would be 50
yeah.
years.
Oh, wait, what did I say, 450? 450 to 520?
Oh, 70 years.
70 years, yeah. Yeah, so if my math is right, and I'm pretty sure it is, it would be, let's see here. Yeah, the rebuilding of Jerusalem was 450, yep. Yeah, we'll get to that in just a second. So, yeah, it would have been 70 years prior to that, so about 520 BC.
Another time period that is helpful for me, it's, I wrote down here, about 860 years after Joshua led them into the Promised Land was the fall of Jerusalem.
Okay.
So that's quite a few years.
Let me see. I'm just curious. I'm just going to look back at Joshua and see if I have the same dates. Joshua would have been in the late 1400s. And, so that's about right. Yeah, yep, that's right. Yeah, so there was quite a long time there.
Than there today, you know, we think 200 years starting the country or 230 or whatever it is, like, even
yeah.
pilgrims get here 400 years ago, and
I know.
You can't even imagine that.
Yeah.
And yet, this is 860, huh?
Yeah, I know. Isn't it something? It's just, you think back in history, and you read about some despot that ruled for 40 years, and it just seems like it's just a tiny little period of time. We're talking thousands of years ago. That's like half the lifetime of somebody. You just think about that. Or even in history, you'll be reading about dates and they might be 10 years apart, and I just have a notion to say, well, that was the same time. Well, not really. I mean, when you're talking 1,000 years ago, 10 years seems like the same time, but think about 10 years in your own life, it doesn't really seem like the same time, right? Okay, so what book comes after 2 Kings? Who knows?
Chronicles.
First Chronicles and Second Chronicles, that's right. I don't have much to say about 1 and 2 Chronicles because they are basically just a summary of what happens in a lot of 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. Chronicles also contain a lot of genealogies going the whole way back to Adam. So there's valuable information in there for sure. And you can also, by cross-referencing 1 and 2 Chronicles with Samuel and the Kings, you can get a lot of additional information, kind of like you can when you cross-reference the Gospels. If you look in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John at the same story, you get additional information. You get additional information when you go between the Kings and the Chronicles as well. So that takes us to the next book. What book comes after 2 Chronicles? Ezra. Very good. Gene's knocking him out of the park here tonight. Oh, you're there. Well, you cheated. I didn't know that.
I had to look at the 2 Chronicles in 4004 BC, and this is...
Oh, does your Bible give you dates for when they were...
Yeah, the book was written.
Oh, that's nice. Okay.
So I was...
There you go.
No,
yeah.
Checking things off.
Yeah. Okay, so the next books, I've kind of grouped Ezra and Nehemiah together because, like I said, this is a broad overview. And actually, in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, Ezra and Nehemiah was one book. That's what it was called, Ezra and Nehemiah. They both cover the same events, just from different standpoints. But Nehemiah was the king's cupbearer in Babylon, and or it would have probably been the Medo-Persian Empire by that time, because the Medes and the Persians took over the Babylonian Empire after Israel had been there close to the... I'm not sure exactly how long they'd been there, but anyway, by the time the 70 years was up, the Medo-Persians had already taken over. So Nehemiah was the king's cupbearer. Nehemiah was concerned for the welfare of his people, and the king sent Nehemiah back with a bunch of money and orders to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple. And it was King Darius which made the decree. I think it was Darius.
Pretty sure. Wasn't Cyrus?
Cyrus. King Cyrus, not Darius. Cyrus made the decree. Was it Cyrus? I think it was Cyrus, yeah. Because that was right at the end of... let me just double check. Yeah. King Cyrus, yes, thank you, not Darius. King Cyrus made the decree to send them back. So that basically Ezra and Nehemiah cover the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the rebuilding of the temple. And there was a lot of drama that went on there. And there were a lot of enemies that tried to stop the building. And they tried to stop them militarily. They tried to stop them legally and by getting, you know, saying they were doing it illegally. And they went back and found the records back where the king had made the commandment for them to go rebuild the temple. And so they ended up getting it rebuilt. And this would have been the second temple that Israel had, which was basically just a reconstruction of the first one. And then there was a third temple. It wasn't really a third temple, but it was a beautification of the second temple done by King Herod back in the days, in the Maccabean time, there in that 400-year period between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. And he did a lot of work to it and really spruced it up. Okay, so that takes us to the book of Esther. And Esther is quite an interesting story. Esther is the only book of the Bible which does not even mention the name of God, believe it or not. In the whole book, God's name is not mentioned. Now, certainly divine providence is clearly shown there if you read it. Esther takes place likely between about 486 and 465 BC, during the reign in the Persian Empire. And it's centered around a Jewish girl named Esther. And she ended up becoming the queen of the Persian Empire, and she ended up saving the Jewish people from being slaughtered. And if you remember how the story goes, there was the king of the Medes or the Persians had a queen, her name was Vashti, and he wanted her to come in and parade around for his buddies to see how beautiful his wife was, and she didn't want to do it, and she said no. And they said, well, we can't have this. You know, this gets out, the rest of the women in the kingdom are going to find out that the king's wife wasn't submissive to him, and we're going to have a rebellion on our hands, some kind of a mutiny. So they got rid of Vashti, I don't know how you pronounce her name, and they decided, well, the king needed to get a new queen. So they went throughout the whole kingdom, and they had people, fair, young, beautiful women picked out that would come, and they would take, I think, a whole year to get all prepped and ready and looking pretty and smelling nice and then come to the king, and then he would pick the one that he liked the best. And this little Jewish girl named Esther ended up being picked, and she was taken care of by her uncle Mordecai. And so then Mordecai was a good man, good Jew, and there was a guy named Haman who was one of the king's right-hand men, right-hand men, basically. And this guy Haman wanted to be bowed down to, and most everybody else would do it except for Mordecai. He was a Jew, and you can't serve anybody but God, and so he wouldn't do it, and this infuriated Haman. And so Haman comes up with this plan that he's going to kill Mordecai. And he, in order to kill him, he's just going to kill all the Jews. So he's just going to wipe them all out. And he talks the king into making this decree that on such and such a day, they would kill all this. He didn't tell it was going to be the Jews, but he told him it was going to be these pestilential people here that are causing us problems. So when they find this out, Mordecai is obviously concerned, and he goes to Esther, and he tells her to go to the king and see if you can rectify the situation. Well, in the meantime, Haman had built this great big gallows to hang Mordecai on, and it didn't end up working out so well for him. Mordecai, prior to that, had saved the king's life, and this had been written down in the Chronicles, not in the Bible Chronicles, but in the Chronicles of that kingdom. And so the king's having a hard time sleeping one night, and he has him bring out the Chronicles and to read him the Chronicles. And if you have a hard time sleeping, if you get out the Book of Chronicles and you read through some of those genealogies, you should probably go to sleep pretty fast. And so anyway, they're reading in the Chronicles, and he reads about Mordecai saving the king's life, and he'd forgotten about this. And he asked somebody, well, has this guy ever been rewarded or honored for this? And they said no. So he calls in Haman, and he says to Haman, what should be done for the guy that should be honored by the king? And of course, Haman, being the proud man that he is, thinks, well, who else could he possibly be talking about but me? And then he says, well, you know, put a gold ring on his hand and put a nice robe on him and put him, you know, exalt him and hellhole him around or whatever. I forget all the details that he had there. So he's like, okay, well, go do that to Mordecai. Well, you can imagine how Haman felt. So Haman is basically ends up begging for his life, and he goes and he's somehow managed to land on top of the king's wife and pleading for his life. And the king thinks that something nefarious is going on there, and that really makes him mad. And so he says, go, hang Haman on the gallows that he made for Mordecai, and he ends up being hanged on these gallows. So anyway, then Esther goes into the king, and because the king has already made this decree that the Jewish people are going to be wiped out throughout the whole kingdom, all 127 provinces, I think it was 127. And so if you remember the thing about the law of the Medes and the Persians, what was the thing? What was the special thing about the law of the Medes and the Persians? You remember? It altereth not, it was said. It cannot be reversed. So when they made a law, there was no reversing it. And that's pretty much like our laws. There's pretty much no reversing them. I mean, can you think of a program that's actually been reversed and taken away? I can't. But anyway, there was no reversing it, so the king couldn't do anything about it. So Mordecai talks Esther into going before the king and asking, pleading for the Jews. And she goes in there at peril to her own life and ends up talking to the king. And he can't stop it, but he said, you know, we're going to send out messages throughout all the provinces to all the Jews and tell them to get ready because on this day they're going to be exterminated. And so they all got ready and they ended up beating the soup out of all their enemies. Which, by the way, Israel still refers to today. That snake Netanyahu, he referred to the Book of Esther and to this very story whenever he stood before Congress and tried to talk us into blowing up Iran. So anyway, yeah, they still get mileage out of this story, even though they don't probably believe it. So that takes care of the book.
That's what got Daniel in trouble, too, because the king had to go through with his...
That's right. It was the same exact type of thing.
Yeah. Go ahead and throw him in the lion's den because he couldn't back out of it.
That's right.
They tried to trap him,
You would think that these Persian kings would figure it out after a while. Geez, these guys come to me with this great idea and they don't explain anything to me, and I put my stamp on it and now I can't go back on it, but apparently not. All right, so that takes us through the book of Esther. And the next book is Book of Job. Yes, the book of Job. Now, up until this point, things have been going along pretty much chronologically. Actually, I guess up until Ezra and Nehemiah, then Esther would actually go back a little bit before Ezra and Nehemiah. And but with the book of Job, now we get way out of the time scale here. The book of Job is believed to be the oldest book of the Bible. It was probably written, and I don't have a definite date for you here, but we can deduce that it was written during the patriarchal times, between Noah's flood, after Noah's flood, and before the law of Moses. So somewhere in that time period, which would have been between the time period of 2390 BC, which would have been the flood of Noah, and 1533, which would have been the law of Moses given. So somewhere in that, granted that's a large time period, but somewhere in that time period, the book of Job was likely written. And the reason why we know that it was written at that time was that there's a reference to Noah in the flood, or there's a reference to Noah's flood in the book. The reason that we know, or that I believe that Job was definitely written after the flood of Noah, well, for one thing, it would have been probably hard for the parchments to have survived a flood anyway. That would maybe be one good reason. But the one reason is that Job makes reference to the flood of Noah. If you look in Job 22:15-16, Job 22:15-16 says, "Hast thou marked?" Well, I'll wait till you get there. Job 22:15-16. "Hast thou marked the old way which wicked men have trodden, which were cut down out of time, whose foundation was overflown with a flood?" So he's talking about the people back there in the days of Noah that were taken down in the flood. So we know that it was at least written after the flood of Noah, but that doesn't tell us a whole lot because that was in 2390 BC, so there had been a lot of water under the bridge and over the earth for that matter since that time. And then it was probably written before the Law of Moses because there's no mention of the Law of Moses anywhere in the book of Job. So when you think about the rest of the Old Testament, there would always be references to the parts of it that were written after the Law of Moses, there'd be references to the Law of Moses. But there is no reference in here that I'm aware of to the Law of Moses at all. So that would tell me that it was probably written before the Law of Moses at some point, which would make it the oldest book of the Bible because the law, Genesis would have been the first book written by Moses. So anyway, the book of Job would have been written before the other books, but the other books cover information that happened before the book of Job. Like the book of Genesis obviously covers the very beginning. The book of Job records an account of how God allowed Satan to destroy Job's life as a test as to whether Job would serve God faithfully or whether he would curse God and die. And if you remember the book of Job, it was said that he was an upright man that eschewed evil. He was a judge in the land. He was a good man. And Satan comes to God when he still had access to the heavenlies. And he comes there as the accuser. And he says, doth Job serve God for naught? And look at all these things you've given him. Of course he's going to serve you. But, take away his stuff and he'll curse you. So God says, okay, you can take away everything, but don't touch his life. Don't touch his flesh, his body. So he takes away his children. His children get killed by the Sabaeans, I think it was, and loses his cattle and all of his wealth, and he doesn't curse God. And then the devil comes back again, and he says, okay, yeah, skin for skin. And he'll still serve you, of course, because he's still got his health. But touch his flesh, and he will definitely curse you. God says, okay, go ahead, but don't take his life. Well, then the devil afflicts him. He's got boils all over his skin, and he's just in terrible misery, and he's scraping himself with a potsherd, and his wife tells him to curse God and die, and yet he still maintained his integrity. He cursed the day he was born, but he still maintained his integrity. And then along come his three, quote, friends to help him out, to comfort him, and they sit around for a week and don't say anything because he's in such terrible shape. And then they finally open their mouth and they start to accuse Job, and the whole book of Job is basically these guys prognosticating and pontificating about why all this stuff is happening to Job. And it's quite a fascinating read. It's very interesting, and the way that these men spoke was extremely eloquent. And as you read through the book of Job, and it's interesting to just go through there and try to pick out the parts, because some of the things that they say are just wrong. But a lot of the things that they say are right, but many of them are not right about Job. So they're right about wicked men, things that happen to wicked men. You know, even Paul quotes them. He says they taketh the wise in their own craftiness. So, that, I mean, these guys were right about certain people, but they were wrong about Job. And it goes back and forth with Job arguing with these guys, and they're accusing him of all these things, and then Job comes back, and he says, miserable comforters are ye all, and which I don't blame him, I would too. So anyway, at the end of the book of Job, Job ends up showing a little bit of pride that was hidden away in him that he probably never even realized he had. And sometimes that's what affliction will bring out of us, is hidden sins, secret sins that we don't even know about. And then Job then gets a little bit too big for his britches, and he wants to have his day in court with God. Now he wants to talk to God about why all this stuff's happening. And God has a little talk with him, and God just starts out by saying, hey, where were you when I made the foundations of the earth? Where were you when I created the stars? Where were you when I made all this stuff? And Job ends up feeling about this big, and he ends up repenting, and he ends up praying for these friends of his, and God ends up sparing them judgment. And then we read in the book of James that we've seen the patience of Job, and we've seen the end of the, or you've heard of the patience of Job, and we've seen the end of the Lord. Well, the end of the Lord, the end of Job's life, was a blessing from God. And Job got all of his stuff back. He actually got double. He got everything, not his family, but all of his cattle and herds and all of his things, he got doubled back to him. So it's a good story for us to learn to suffer affliction patiently. Then we have the book of Psalms, which is probably one of the most popular books in the Bible, and rightly so. It was compiled, it is, first of all, what it is 150 poetical songs about various things, various lengths. Some of them are quite short, only, well, one of them is two verses long, Psalm 117, I think. And then one of them is 176 verses long, Psalm 119, and anywhere in between. And they were Hebrew songs, like our hymn book, we have songs in it. Well, the book of Psalms were songs, and I would probably guess that they have a rhyme or a meter or something to them in the Hebrew, though they probably don't have the same thing in the English, because it's not the same language. But anyway, they were songs at that time, and they were sung. And sometimes have we sung any psalms? I know that there are some hymn books that have psalms in them. I don't know if ours does. I'm not aware of that. But anyway, it wouldn't be a bad idea if we could learn some to sing, because it does say to sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. The Psalms were written by various authors. One of the main ones was David. David was called the sweet psalmist of Israel. And those Psalms, at least the ones written by David, would have been written between 983 and 943 BC, the 40 years there when David was reigning as king. And of course, in the Psalms, we have comforting words, and we have prophecy, and we have praise of God and his word. So a lot of times, whenever we're having a hard time, when we're going through the loss of a loved one or depression or whatever problems that we suffer, there's always a psalm that speaks to that. And if friends go against you or you're suffering affliction or whatever it might be, there's all kinds of psalms that that are both there to comfort you when you're mourning and to lift you up whenever you're feeling depressed and to help you praise God and think on him. The next book would be the Proverbs. The Proverbs were written by Solomon, almost exclusively by Solomon. You do have Proverbs 30 that was written by Agur, the son of Jakeh. But other than that, the majority of them were written by Solomon. And those would have been written in between the time of 943 and 903 BC. And Proverbs are a compilation of pithy sayings about different aspects of life. Proverbs are things that are generally true, that are just to be observed in life, generally true. Not universally and always true, and I'll give you an example. This is my favorite one. You get a proverb, don't remember the reference right now, but you get a proverb that says that when a man's ways please the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. Well, that's generally true. When you're a good man and God's pleased with your ways, you're going to get along with people pretty well, right? Let me ask you a question. Did Jesus Christ's ways please the Lord? Mm-hmm. Of course they did, right? Were his enemies made at peace with him? Mm-hmm. Not all of them, were they? So these things generally hold true. Train up a child in the way that he should go. When he is old, he shall not depart from it. This is generally true. Has there ever been a child that has been trained up right and did depart from it and didn't come back? Yeah, of course there has. But generally speaking, these things are true. And there's tons of wisdom in the Proverbs. And I personally recommend reading a proverb a day corresponding to the day of the month. So today is, what is today? The 16th. So this morning I read Proverbs 16. And if you do that, you'll end up reading the whole book of Proverbs 12 times a year, because you're reading, you know, the whole book once a month. And then do that over the course of a lifetime, and you'll end up having the whole book memorized. And you'd be amazed. I've done it for about 10 years now or so, and it's amazing to me how many Proverbs I have memorized. I might not be able to just give me a reference, I couldn't tell you what it is necessarily, but give me the first half of the proverb, and I'm just shocked that you can just spit out the second half without even thinking about it. So anyway, I would definitely recommend reading a proverb a day, because that's where we find wisdom. The next book is the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes was also written by whom? Who wrote Ecclesiastes? Solomon, right? Is that what you said? Yep. Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes, as well as Proverbs. And this would have been written somewhere in the same time as Proverbs, in 943 to 903 BC. And the book of Ecclesiastes, if you've ever read it, is an exposé on the vanity and the futility of life without God. And if there was ever a man that could write about it, it was Solomon, because as we just learned here a few minutes ago, Solomon had all the wealth, all the women, all the power. He had everything. And yet, he found that life was vain without God. And he sums up the book of Ecclesiastes in Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13, I think it is. And he says, "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." But he goes through and he just shows how everything is vain. In Ecclesiastes chapter 2, he says that he had it all. He had men singers, he had women singers, he had servants born in his house, he had gardens, he had trees, he had orchards with trees planted and all kinds of fruits. He had everything that heart could wish. And yet, he says it's all vanity and vexation of spirit. He sought after wisdom, he sought after folly. No matter what, all he found everywhere that he went was vanity. And when you're kind of a person, cup half full type of guy like I can tend to be sometimes, I really like Ecclesiastes because it just kind of speaks to the way that things actually are.
Matthew Henry says it's a sermon in print.
A sermon in print, yeah. That's about right, too.
A sermon in print.
Yep. And probably the last book that I'm going to cover tonight, let me see how much... Oh, yeah, this will be just perfect. The last book that we'll cover tonight would be the last of the writings. Remember, the Old Testament's broken up into three sections. The Law, which is the first five books, Genesis, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. And then you have the writings, which go from Joshua to the Song of Solomon. And the Song of Solomon was written by, guess who? Solomon. The name kind of gave it away. It was a love letter written between Solomon and his wife. Now, some people like to spiritualize the whole book and say that this is a picture of Christ in the church. And I wouldn't disagree that there may be some spiritual parallels there. But primarily, this is a love letter between Solomon and his wife. And some of the old Jewish rabbis said, some people didn't even think Solomon was so graphic. They didn't even think the Song of Solomon was so graphic. They didn't even think it should be included in the Bible. And one of the rabbis said that a young man ought not to read this until he's 30 years old. So if you read it and you know what you're reading and you can read between the lines and understand the word pictures and everything, it's pretty graphic. I will not give you a verse-by-verse exposition to save you the blushing. And in it, the joy of marital love is exalted. There's a couple of great passages in the Song of Solomon for weddings, like where it says love is strong as death and passages like that. So next time, we'll pick it up with the prophets. We'll get into the major and the minor prophets, and we'll start off with the book of Isaiah. So thank you for your kind and patient attention tonight.